Well, thank you very much to nobody here who invited me. But nonetheless, David asked me to come back again. And so I'm very grateful to David. I honestly enjoy so much coming here. I don't know, it's not only just the air outside, but it really is for me like a breath of fresh air. So I really do enjoy coming. This little passage that we've had read to us is, from my point of view, is plucked out of the blue. I actually thought that you would have been studying Mark's Gospel and that you'd got to the stage where you were looking at this part of chapter 3. And so I've just learnt that, in fact, that's not the case. And that's really intriguing. Let me, however, begin somewhere. look, in the ancient world, in the world of Palestine, for instance, if you had broken your femur — your femur is everyone knows, is your largest bone in your body, it's between your hip — you've got two of them, of course — between your hip and your knee. If you had broken your femur, the pain — I have actually broken my femur, so I know — the pain is unbelievable. It is the largest bone in your body. And I actually asked God to help me to faint. And I was out for it for about 3 days. I'd suffered concussion as well, so that really helped. It actually did. The pain is incredible. In due course — and people would have had to have looked after you, you can't really walk, there's no way in the world you could walk, the pain would be excruciating — you'd be looked after, people would come and feed you and so on, and clothe you and do other things that were necessary. Over a period, if you were not too old, over a period of, say, 3 months, healing would take place. The unfortunate thing is, unless they did practice something like it in the ancient world — and I don't think it would have applied probably to anybody, and if it did, it only would have been to the aristocracy — you would have ended up with a very short leg, and it would be shortened by perhaps as much as 15 centimetres, even more. So you can imagine that you now have one leg that's 15 centimetres, you know, it's this sort of thing. It's that shorter than the other leg. So for the rest of your life, you basically are a wizened person. You will lean to the left if it's, for instance, that's where your short leg is. That's for the rest of your days. You will hobble. You will bend over backwards and you will hobble from side to side, from side to side. You will drag that leg around. You will swing it around. Incredible disability. Imagine that you came across a man, perhaps in a little church service, in the Jewish world, a synagogue service. And you used to go there occasionally with a crutch. You put your crutch up against the wall. And in the middle of this service, this man asked you to stand up. I've been going to a physio lately, and she, every now and again, she'll say things like, "Sit down. Stand up." And I say to her, "You're a school man. That's what they do in school." But imagine in this church service, this man had said to you, "Stand up." You went over to the wall. You grabbed your crutch. And you got to your feet and you're embarrassed. And then he said to you, "Stretch out your leg." An impossibility. It had been like that for years. But somehow or other, almost involuntarily, you stretched it out. And now it is brand spanking new. It's the full length. The muscles are back. The sinews, the tendons, they're all working perfectly. Just as good as the other leg anyway. How astonishing that would be. How astonishing that would be. Imagine the stir in everybody else. Well, in effect, that's the way that reading from Mark begins. It's just before it. It wasn't a man who'd broken a femur, it was a man with a withered arm. And the same thing happened to him, as in my imaginary story. Before it happened, however, Jesus was in conflict with a number of people who were there in the church. This was a Jewish holy day. This was a Sabbath. And there was this air about Jesus that he somehow or other sometimes contravened the appropriate religious beliefs and practices. And there was a murmur in the air. This man has a reputation for doing things like this. This is before it happened. But this is the Sabbath. On the Sabbath you don't do such things. But they were waiting to see what he would do. Perhaps they'd even invited the man with the withered arm along themselves as a bit of a get him going, as it were. Make him do the wrong thing. So just before this extraordinary event occurred, Jesus, it says, with anger and being very, very disturbed at this attitude that they had, said to them these words. Is it better to do good or to do evil? Is it better to save life or to destroy it? What he did was he saved the life. Well, saved a man's arm. It was his life. Now, at the end of that, what happened, and it would have happened over a period of time, but at the end of that, the Pharisees, the religious hierarchy, the ones that looked so noble and behaved so religiously, the Pharisees decided this man had to die. See the irony, by the way, in Mark's gospel? See the irony? Is it better to save life or to destroy it? He saves life, and the Pharisees say, we'll destroy him. It's the irony. And it then says they took counsel with the Herodians. Herodians were an aristocratic nobility group that had nothing really to do with the Pharisees. They weren't really thoroughgoing Jews. They supported the puppet king under the Roman world in the world of Galilee. And those two enemies came together because for various reasons and for different reasons they saw Jesus as a threat. By the way, it's a great warning. Formal religion doesn't like being threatened, even by nobility, good things, the truth. This is no disrespect for the Pope or Roman Catholicism, but imagine today that you had the newly installed Pope and he's there on the great balcony and there's the great crowd down there in front and he's about to give a great blessing and suddenly there's a bit of a stir in the crowd and someone starts with great rhetoric and ability, starts speaking and then does something extraordinary, like heal a person. Can't you imagine the religious people of the day being disturbed, saying, stop that, stop that! We want to hear him! The formal religion, when threatened, is a terrible beast to come against, and Jesus was faced with it. Now that begins our account. Sorry, I thought I had to introduce that because you didn't have any Mark build-up. Now, when you read Mark's gospel, Mark, I think from what I've now learning in recent years, I think Mark does what is not atypical in his day in his own literature. That is, he just collapses events. He collapses things that Jesus does. He collapses things that Jesus says, and he puts them all together. And when you start reading Mark's gospel, you say, goodness me, in the space of a few days, all these things happen. Well, that's just his style. If you look at the other Gospels, you find that, in fact, Jesus does things over an extended period of time, you know, something like 2.5 years. You read Mark's Gospel, goodness me, the first part, you think it almost happened in 1 week. And, in fact, that's the way he writes. But contrary to our way of writing, in the ancient world, all sorts of things were possible, and no one took any notice. No one said, oh, come on, it didn't really happen in that strict time sequence. People said, no, but that's my liberty as an historian to write that way. And that's the way, therefore, I think Mark wrote. So you've got this view of Mark doing things, you know, fairly quickly. Well, fairly quickly after this, according to Mark, but it may have been some time, Jesus becoming aware that, in fact, he was his own life was in danger, and not wanting, in fact, his ministry to be curtailed at this early time, it says he withdraws from... Now, the previous story probably happened in Capernaum. Now, which is the green thing here? That was the bad thing to do. there it is. Yeah, well done. Oh, yeah. Now, what happened was, he was... Capernaum is probably not on the map there, but it's around about that little point there. That's the Sea of Galilee, or the Lake of Galilee. It had three different names that we come across. And he may have actually then decided simply to get out of the town, because he's better off in the open air. By the way, it's more difficult to bring about an assassination in the open air, depending upon the circumstances. And he gets away from the formal religious world. He gets away from the synagogue where he's been, and he's actually now preaching, but he's also every now and again doing some extraordinary things. And in fact, one of the things you come across is how practical Jesus is. As I said, can you imagine what happens if their story got around about the man with the withered arm? I mean, there'd be all sorts of people with withered arms or broken femurs or all sorts of things saying, whoa, I wonder if he could do that for me. By the way, there's no indication that the man with the withered arm said, what about me? There's no indication of that. He's just selected. So what happens is you get this account in Mark's Gospel which says that Jesus, having withdrawn, he's going to get him moving out of the town, he's moving out of that part of the world, he's moving away from danger, his ministry must not be curtailed, and he goes to this lake, and he instructs his disciples. He says, look, the crowd's actually building up, get a boat for me so I can get in the boat and be removed a little bit from the seashore so that people aren't going to wade that far into the water, and at least I've got some sort of a control over what's going on. Now, by the way, when it says there was a crowd, how many? Well, it's impossible to tell. But the word, the Greek word that we translate crowd, could stand for something like 15 people. Probably that's a bit too small, you know, 50 certainly, 100. We do know of other instances where Jesus had crowds, and they're given numbers like 4,000 men or 5,000 men. But it might have only been a few hundred, but that's a crowd. It might have been 400 or 500. That's getting pretty big. And Jesus adopts these practical procedures to deal with the crowd. Now, by the way, you can understand people almost wanting to line up, saying, what about me, what about me? And the crowd seems to be there, not so much in this instance because of his teaching, it's because of these extraordinary things he's doing. And he does two sorts of things. They're basically classified into two sorts. And that is, he delivers people from diseases. It's a general term. So it might have to do with the fact that you've had a bad ulcer, or your liver's gone, or it might have to do with the fact that you're blind in one eye, or that you've lost an arm, or you know, a whole host of things is covered by that. And the other one, it might seem very strange, is he deals with the demon possessed. Now, all I can say is that I think what you've got is the phenomenon happening around Jesus, which was not all that common in the ancient world or in our world. It's certainly not all that common in the Western world, because if Satan's going to operate through demon-possessed people in the Western world, he's going to defeat his own purposes. People are going to start to say, wow, there's more of this world than I thought there was. So I think, in fact, demonic possession belongs more to a world where, in fact, you believe in the demons anyway, and it's not counterproductive for the demons to do their work. But you see, here you have in this figure, this one man, this astonishing man, you have this enormous sort of focus of attention around him because... of who he is, and you have a demonic world, and Jesus delivers people from the demonic world. Well, anyway, where did the crowd come from? And by the way, you don't have to actually come, you don't have to have many that come from there, but you see, if someone comes from Queensland and say, oh, can you stand up quick? No, don't stand up. Say, you've been in those meetings where people ask you to raise your hand and say, anyone, you know, come from the Illawarra? Anyone who's come from, you know, further than Newcastle and stuff? Well, you only need a few, and you can say, well, look, they came from. Where did they come from? Well, you can just get rid of those if you don't mind. they're good. But we'll just go through where, in fact, that doesn't matter if you can't. Okay, what they do is they certainly come from Judea, which is down here. They come from Galilee, which is, of course, the area. There's no doubt about that. There's no problem there. They come from Judea generally, which is an area here. They come from Idumea, which is, wow, we are now talking 3, 4, maybe 5 days. I tell you what, males, certainly, maybe females, in the ancient world, you were supposed to be able to walk, you know, easily, no problem, 24, you know, 30 kilometres a day. So it wasn't, so if you'd have gone up and told that little story,
you know, earlier about walking, people said, yeah, big deal. I do that every month or something like that. But it's impressive to us. Don't worry, we were impressed. But, you know, you're talking now fairly large. You're talking about a four-day. How come you would be able to travel 4 or 5 days? Who are you? There's a good chance you might be a business person. So you can afford that. It's not in season for harvest. You can do that. So you've got to have some ability to be able to say, I can take time off from my family, my business. And so you're probably only looking at a few sorts of people, but some of them came as far as down here, Idumea. Now, there's another place that's mentioned. It says they came from beyond the Jordan. That probably includes that area there. They came from beyond the Jordan. They also came from Tyre and Sidon. Now, Tyre and Sidon was a general name for stuff up here. So you're looking for stuff here, stuff there. You're not looking for Samaria. Samaria's there. Samaria's non-Jewish. Not interested in this person. Probably they're making up lies about him. Thank you very much. That's where they're coming from. This man's famous. Now, the first part of the story simply has to do with the fact that there's a great crowd and they want to be healed. And can you imagine every now and again someone almost being fifth in line, fourth in line, third in line, second in line? Or, you know, of course there weren't lines, but I just cannot myself, this is just myself, I cannot imagine Jesus continually doing it. Every now and again it just calls a halt. That's it. Just... He wouldn't be able to eat. He wouldn't be able to sleep. The best understanding I think we have is that he just, every now and again, things called. Maybe he did deal with everyone who was there. Maybe there were 250 people there, and maybe there were only 30 people who really had a bad disease. I don't know, but he just calls a halt. He has to, and he has to sleep somewhere. He has to eat and so on. Now, this is the first part, the crowd. Now, what happens right at the end, however, is that we hear that a demon-possessed being, and I think this is what it means, is a demon-possessed being, extraordinary stuff, falls down in front of Jesus. Now, I take it that what's happening is that the people are wading out into the water, some of them, the ones who want to be healed, and getting fairly close to Jesus, a person, but again, it's Mark's way of collapsing things, so who knows exactly what went on, but a person themselves falls down, and then the person speaks, and the way that it's painted in the thing, it's the demon who's speaking. And basically what the demon says is, you are the Son of God! Now, what is the demon trying to do? You see, I used to be a school teacher, and you got a class of people there and so on, and you think they're all doing pretty well, and then you notice, look at James, he's got his head down, he's passing a note. And what do? You see, as a school teacher, you say, James, you've got control of James. You just used his name and you got control. This is the attempt in the demonic world. It's an ancient world sort of a view of things. If you knew something that was in a sense secretive about the person, something that was really intrinsic to the nature of that person, and if you came out with it in the open, you dominated that person, you see. So you thought you got away with it. Sorry, I didn't mean to point to anyone, but you thought you got away with it. You thought you got away with it. You've been hiding this all along. See, let's imagine I used the word, and I'm not pointing to anyone, adulterer. And how did they know? See, you're under control. Now, here it's not an adulterer, but the demon says, Son of God! See, I've named you. I've got control over you. See, that's the attempt by the demon. And what does Jesus say? Now, it obviously has to be, I think, fairly controlled. Maybe there's no shouting, because Jesus basically says, and the text reads this way, actually, the word is used, he rebukes the demon. I think it's like this. He so speaks to the demon that he says something like this. Ha! You think you're in charge of me? No, I'm in charge of you. I forbid you to speak like that. In other words, he will not have who he is known at this point in time. It's inappropriate for his ministry for a variety of reasons. But you see, whereas the demon wants to assert authority over Jesus, Jesus asserts authority over the demon. That's the first little bit. The second little bit, got to hurry on. Second little bit, in the notes that there I've called the team. It's a very inappropriate title. I mean, how insulting to the apostles to be called member of the team. It didn't upset anybody. Jesus actually designates them as apostles. There's the Greek word that we've got used there, and it actually has a special meaning.
So what happens is the next little bit says he removes himself from the lake. This is again Mark collapsing things, maybe, who knows exactly what the time frame was, but Jesus withdraws himself to a mountain. Now, in Palestine, the really big mountains are down here, but they're not all that big anyway. Not by modern standards. You know, Everest, these little tiny bumps. The biggest mountain that we probably come across in the biblical record is Mount Sinai, and it's about 2,000 metres. So these sorts of mountains are, you're looking at 800 metres, 600 metres, that sort of stuff. Now, if he really is associated with that lake up there, those things, I don't know what height they are. I've never been there. I'd love to go to Palestine and so on. But my guess is they may be no bigger than a few hundred metres, mountains. But for instance, it could be as though you were on Penrith, Emu Plains, right out west. Sorry, Queensland, near the mountains, Blue Mountains, right? It could be that there you're in the plains and you say, right, I'm going up to Glenbrook. Glenbrook's not very far, a couple of stations up. By the way, if you do travel that way, you notice that huge ravine on the left-hand side of the railway line, if you go there, huge ravine. Now, some, I don't know about the hills at the around about the lake there, but generally in Palestine, the mountains had been denuded over many years of a lot of forestation and so on, a lot of pasture land, but also riddled with ravines and isolated spots. So that was spots basically which you didn't want to go to normally. If you were there, it would be difficult for you. You wouldn't be able to easily get back to other people and so on. They are spots of isolation. That's the message that I think we ought to get across to ourselves. So Jesus goes up into a spot of isolation. Again, this is practicality. Get away from the crowds. I've got something important. It's in-house now. So I've got to get away from the crowds. And it's not clear from the text exactly whether there were some people who came with what we now call the 12. You can't say whether there's some that came with him or he just got the 12 and said, look, come up with me up into the mountains. Make a guess, this is my guess. You couldn't stop some people wanting to go with him. That is my guess, that there would have been other people saying, oh, hang on, he's on the move. You come with me. Get some bread, get some tucker, and we'll see where he goes. And so you might have followed him up into the hills, the hilly regions. But there we discover that Jesus actually selects people. Again, this is practicality. This is the man, astonishingly, extraordinarily doing wonderful things, and no one like him as a teacher, but he'll die. The man will die. He will come back from the dead, but then he will be removed from this universe. So we've got the man. What about the message? So what Jesus does, you see, he picks a team. That's what it is, he picks a team. And it's clear from the text there are two things he does with the team, or two things that the team have to do. One, they have to be with him. Why? Because they're in school. They've got to learn. That's what a disciple for anybody was, a learner. So these are people who have to be taught, number one. Number two, they then have to be sent out. That's what apostle means. They're the ones who are going to go out into the world. Now, what is interesting, of course, is there are 12 of them. It's highly symbolic. And perhaps going up into the mountain was symbolic. He's a bit like a Moses under these circumstances. Mount Sinai, you go up and God deals with you and teaches you and instructs you and informs you. Well, Moses then informs the 12 tribes. These are the people of God. Jesus selects 12. Make no bones about it. They, I think, in the end would have got the message even then. We stand for the Israel of God. We are the new people of God. Now, we've got their names there, and I've got a list there. There's 12 there. You can have a look at it in your own time. I've put little things underneath them sometimes. Simon, he gets called Peter and so on. The first three get named. Those first three, by the way, that are named, they are the important three.
There are two important incidences in the life of Jesus where those three, the other nine, are not present. For instance, in the Mount of Transfiguration, it's Peter, James and John who actually accompany Jesus in an extraordinary situation. We won't go into that. In the Garden of Gethsemane, just before he dies, he actually calls those three to come in especially. They are extraordinary people. So in other words, not everyone in the 12 is equal. Got different parts to play. I mean, Peter will become very prominent in the very early days, and then he sort of fades away, and Paul, a new bloke, comes in, actually, not even one of the 12. But Peter certainly has an important part to play for all his days. John has an extraordinary part to play. We're all so thrilled that we've got John's gospel, if you've got any sense. James doesn't feature all that much, except that he's killed by Herod, and he was the leader of the early church in Jerusalem. And yet you think, how did he get there? Why wasn't Peter there? No, James. They are extraordinary men. And you get the mention of Thomas, and say, oh, I know a bit about Thomas, and called the twin or something or other. And I've heard of Philip, the Acts of the Apostles. He does a bit of travelling. That's why I call him the traveller of some. But I'll tell you, aren't they a funny lot? I mean, there are four of them who are fishermen. Oh, by the way, the two blokes who were called Sons of Thunder, we don't know really what it means, is they just might have been a bit like Newman. They use their voice a lot and shout a bit. Noisy people. You know, irritating perhaps sometimes and interrupting. I don't know. We don't quite know. But what an odd lot. Four fishermen. One tax collector. One political zealot like an abbot or whoever. I mean... Now, this is the thing we must think of. What effect does this little passage in the middle of Mark, a bit of Mark, what effect does it have on you, the reader, in the first century? And the tradition is that the book of Mark ended up being given, it would have had a sort of editorial processes presumably, but it ended up being for Christians in Rome. And this is a period of time probably when persecution is on the horizon or already you're experiencing it. Some people are being perhaps killed for the sake of Jesus. So what does even this little tiny bit of Mark do for you? I think it would do a number of things for you. I think that the whole of Mark is supposed to be what it does for you, so we're doing a bit of a funny thing by saying what does a little passage do for you. But look, the crowd, it just reinforces you in your view of this Jesus. This amazing man is the man to whom I've committed myself. This is the man whom I'm following. Sure, I'll read later how he died for me, and I know that. In this little passage, this is the man who does extraordinary things. And I've sold my life to him. I can do no other. I've got the right man, see? And the second little bit, you'd say, hey, yeah, I recognise one of these, that's Peter. And he actually brought the gospel to me. That is tradition. They got the message from the master. They were taught, they were set out, that's how I've heard. I got the man, I got the message. I think that's the sort of thing it might have done. Sorry, I'll be on a bit over time, I think. Is there time for a bit of questions or not? Time for some questions.
Yes.
Comments, questions, anything you like. Hey, come on. Yes, good on you. I think that's an interesting thought. I think, training, absolutely important. And then you went to the... training is important. That is, we all need to learn. What you see in this, in spite of, as well as the extraordinary, you see this practicality. And the practicality is, in this case, that you're referring to, is training. People have to be taught. No one goes away saying, yeah, got it all. And sometimes young Christians think like that. Oh, yeah, got everything. No, I'm sorry.
We make mistakes, and history tells us we make lots of mistakes. We always need to be learning. We always need to be ready to actually recognise where we've got it wrong, get things better off and so on. And we need to get up and go. And by the way, the big thing about a team is you're not on your own. And so I think, yes, I think there are some very practical sort of hints about how we should be doing things. And hopefully that's the way we generally operate. Yes?
Do you think demon possession is going on today like it was then?
The question is, do I think demon possession is going on today? I don't know much about it. I've never come across it myself. However, you read things about things that happen sometimes in some mission fields, and I think it just looks like demon possession to me. So I tried to sort of hint, it's just my guess, it's just Newman's guess, that in the Western world, generally demonic displays would be, I would think, counterproductive. Because the Western world wants to just live life, yeah, be superstitious, do all sorts of stuff like that. But if I had a very obvious display of something that doesn't belong to the world that I think is all that there is, I might even start thinking seriously about God. So my suspicion is that in the Western world you don't find the phenomenon, but you do read accounts, and every now and again I think people do exaggerate. People love to talk about the spectacular and they create things, but every now and again I've read things and I think that's not exaggeration. The person is just telling you as it is. And in another world where people believe in the demons are there. That's my own guess.
I get bothered by some of the bits and pieces in there. You mentioned the people of Samaria seem to be left out of that list.
Yes.
Why are the people from Idumea put
Udumea.
In?
Well, the Udumeans, I don't know how to pronounce half these words, but if it's something like that, they had, from my understanding, is they were Edomites historically,
yeah,
who'd become pseudo-Jewish. So, and what you're looking at is a sort of a borderland area, probably from Idumea. So they're from Judea. So my suspicion is that what you're looking is at least pseudo-Jewish, if not sometimes thoroughly as Jewish as you could be if you came from an Edomite background. But Samaritans, really, the animosity between the Samaritans and the Jews was pretty intense.
But there's still there's another bit. As you mentioned, Jesus picks out the guy with the shriveled hand. He might have been the only one with a disability there, or it might have been... There's just a little bit of unsatisfying storytelling as far as Jesus then seems to heal a number of people, but there's no suggestion he's healed everyone before
moves
on.
No.
Any comment on the... Yeah, it's not the way I would have scripted it.
No. Well, I think one of the things that we develop schemes, systems, and we're happy... They're systems that we develop in our intellectual systems. We're happy with systems because systems, by the nature of systems, make sense, you see. So one system that goes around is that Jesus only responds to, whether it's miraculous or words of forgiveness, to faith, right? That is part of a system of feeling. I don't think, my own view is that is not an appropriate position. So that my own view is that Jesus does whatever he wills. It does say in one spot he could not heal many there because there was not much faith. I'm not saying it doesn't play a part, but there is no indication that the man with the withered hand is a man of faith. I think Jesus, maybe he was the only one with an obvious deformity. I don't think Jesus on that occasion is going to do something with cancer, you see. Everyone says, I didn't see it. Always cancer cures worry me a bit in terms of how people play them, you know, what they think of them. Be grateful to God for any cure you get. Be grateful to God. Give God thanks. However it occurred, be grateful to God. But don't necessarily say it was something really extraordinary. But this was extraordinary. It had to be extraordinary in order to deal with the problem. So I think he is selective. See, this is not in the text, so Newman can be quite wrong. Sorry? Right? I just think that Jesus heals some. Lots of people wanted to be healed. I'm not sure everyone gets healed. You reminded me of something. Why is Jesus doing these two things? Well, it's a display that the rule of God is somehow being manifest in our midst. Oh, wow! You see, you can't have this person, Jesus, who is the king of the kingdom, or the prince of the kingdom, you can't have him coming into the world and somehow the effects of the kingdom not being observed,
and the effects of the kingdom are being observed in one, diseases are inappropriate. Withered hands are inappropriate, broken femurs are inappropriate, it belongs to a wretched world. So what you have is this little sort of a aura goes out and the odd person gets healed. And in this wretched world, the demons should not be in charge. They should not inhabit people. They should not run things. So here and there, the aura goes out and a demon is thrown out. A demon is thrown out. Thank you for reminding me. That's what's happening. This is the display of the kingdom of God. It's like an aura. It just goes out. It's not everywhere. Not every person. But it's there. Little tendrils. Sorry. Oh, you're just sure you'll fly away. I think we must have come to an end. Have we not? Shall I pray? Would you like to pray? Oh, I'll pray. Heavenly Father, it is so rich. We look at some of these passages and we think that they're fairly small and of little consequence. But again, we're reminded of the greatness of your Son and how extraordinary he was, how wonderful that must have been to be there. And also how practical he was. And we do pray that you will help us to see ourselves as learners, members of a team, and people with a message. Help us to remember those things. Amen.